Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. My name is Sean Delaney and you can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. Very often when the topic of education is covered in the mainstream media, it relates to assessment. Leaving Cert and Junior Cert exam results are an annual news topic, and from time to time the results of national and international tests of literacy, maths and science make the headlines. We find out how Irish students performed in the tests compared to students in other countries. But assessment is something that teachers need to think about on an ongoing basis. On this week's programme and in part of next week's programme, we look at the topic of assessment in detail. In order to do that, I am joined by an expert on assessment, Dr. Michael O'Leary from St. Patrick's College in Drumcondra. Michael O'Leary is a principal lecturer in the Education Department at St. Patrick's College and is Director of Postgraduate Studies in Education. He holds a PhD in Educational Research and Measurement from Boston College. I met up with him recently to discuss the topic of assessment, and I began by asking Michael to define assessment.
I see assessment as quite a broad term, Sean. I mean, the definition I use is that assessment is the process of gathering, interpreting, recording, using and communicating information about all aspects of a learner's achievement to help people make decisions. So it's a very, very broad term, much broader term than, for example, a term like testing.
And we're going to get down to talking about some practical things in a minute, yeah. But there's two technical terms I want to ask you about first of all.
Sure.
One of them is reliability. What is the reliability of a test?
The simplest way, I suppose, of describing what reliability is that if you could give the same test to the same child on multiple occasions, would you get consistent information? That's reliability. Yes, you probably are going to ask me about validity.
Yeah. That's the other one, yeah.
Validity, then, on the other hand, is a much more important concept in educational assessment. It's the extent to which the information that you're getting from an assessment is accurate or appropriate for the decision you want to make. Let's say that you gave a sixth class mathematics test to a second class pupil, and that pupil took the test many, many, many times. It's possible for that pupil to get exactly the same result every time. So you would have reliable information. It would be consistent. But I don't think anybody would suggest that making a decision about a child's mathematical ability based on a sixth class test for most children would give you valid information.
If the child is in second class.
If the child is in second class, exactly. Okay. So it's another aspect of validity and reliability of assessments is that we don't actually talk necessarily about a test being valid. It's the actual use to which the information from the test or the assessment is put is we talk about validity in those terms. The last point is that there's no such thing as a perfectly valid assessment, whether it's a test or a teacher-made observation. There's no such thing as absolute perfect reliability or absolute perfect validity. Educational assessment is not like taking a measuring tape and measuring somebody's height, where you get a perfectly accurate outcome and you can say, well, this person is 5'10" or this person is 6'2", and that is valid. That is actually the height they are, assuming that the measuring tape you're using is a good one. But even if you have a really, really good test, you cannot say for definite that the information you get is valid. What we talk about then is high levels of validity or low levels of validity, or high levels of reliability or low levels of reliability.
What kinds of assessment can a teacher use?
The examples I gave for validity and reliability are really examples from testing, because it's an easier concept to deal with when you're explaining those terms. But I will, in answering your question about all the different strategies and methods a teacher can use, the concepts of validity and reliability are also really, really important. Say a teacher is using observation of a junior infant's class and wants to see the extent to which the children can work together in some kind of cooperative environment. And the teacher is looking specifically, for example, the ability of children to take turns and to listen and to take leadership roles and so on and so forth. Those observations will have to be done over time, because a single observation is not going to give you reliable information. You need to be able to see something more than once. It's also possible that if you're observing on a particular day, that a child who is a particularly good listener may not on that particular day exhibit any evidence that he or she is a good listener. So if you make a judgment based on one observation, you may not only have very low reliability, but you'll also have very low validity. So the two concepts in relation to all the different kinds of assessments that teachers can use also apply. But again, I mean, there are many, many different kinds of assessments that teachers can use, all the way from assessments where the child is centrally involved, where the children are given some responsibility for making some self-assessments. So, for example, a teacher may have a writing rubric that he or she is using in a class, and a child in third class may be able to use that particular scoring guide or rubric to make a judgment about his own writing or her own writing, and indeed the writing of another child in the class. So a teacher could use peer and self-assessment in a classroom.
And could you just clarify what a rubric is?
A rubric is simply a scoring guide, usually at three or four levels of performance, where you might say a four-star performance, which has a description of what the writing should be like, a three-star performance, which is not quite as good, but again, a clear description of what writing at that level is like.
And how does the teacher then decide which kind of assessment to use at a particular time?
Nowadays, we talk about assessment of learning and assessment for learning. So things in terms of assessment of learning, first of all, that's the assessment that teachers use at the end of a teaching and learning process. And there are requirements on all Irish teachers to use assessments of learning at particular times during the child's school life. So, for example, teachers have to use standardised assessments at second, fourth and sixth. But most teachers will use those assessments in most classes in most Irish primary schools. Teachers also will use assessments of learning at the end of a period of teaching, say, a topic on something, maybe, let's say, in geography, on the benefits of the Lewis, for example. And the teacher might actually give children a little written assessment on that, or in most cases there probably might be a question and answer session or something to get a sense of what the children know at the end of a period of time. But most of the time, teachers will use what we call assessments for learning. Those assessments are, and what distinguishes them from assessments of learning, they're assessments that teachers use while teaching and learning is still ongoing. So for example, a teacher is teaching something in physical education. And the children, let's say, have been asked to do some task that they're required to do, and the extent to which the children can do it, a teacher could ask the children to give some indication as to whether they found the task easy or difficult or extremely difficult by asking the children to put their thumbs up for a task that they're very comfortable with. The thumb is sideways for something that they feel maybe they're okay with, but they're not terribly good at, and a thumb down for a task that they found extremely difficult and they found maybe that the teacher would have to help them or maybe another child would have to help them. So those kinds of assessments that go on sort of what we call minute to minute, day by day, while teaching and learning is still ongoing, there are many, many, many types of assessments that a teacher can do there. For example, traditional questioning can be used, but it's also possible that a teacher may pose a question, but that the children are given an opportunity to talk to each other before answering the question, rather than putting their hands up. Taking another idea, for example, the teacher might decide that on this occasion she's working on a topic, and that the children respond to each other rather than the teacher. So that's called a response partner, where the teacher may ask a question, but the children respond to each other, and the teacher may listen in to some of their responses. There's another technique called two stars and a wish, where one use of that would be the teacher will look at a piece of writing that the children are doing and identify two elements of the writing that she thinks are really, really good and one thing that that she thinks the child might improve on. So two stars and a wish. There are so many different strategies now that teachers can use. But essentially they can be kind of divided up into assessments of learning and assessments for learning.
Those kinds of assessments, the assessment for learning, do they require the teacher to keep any records of the learning, or is the record keeping mainly associated with the assessment of learning?
You ask a really interesting question, only insofar as I don't like the term formal and informal assessments. I think that it's a slightly prejudicial term, because you think of formal assessments such as end of year tests or Christmas tests or standardized tests, where the teacher makes a note, keeps a record, and that record goes into the office and is a formal record of achievement at a particular point of time. Of course, that is a very formal process. But I think that in terms of record keeping, assessments of learning, that the observations, the outcomes of children giving some indication as to whether they understand something or not, is actually that's formalized, that there is an opportunity for teachers to make quick notes about what she may see during a typical teaching day. Now, that can be done in a number of ways, but a very, I won't say it's an easy way, but it's a very effective way, is that a teacher might keep an anecdotal notebook. And in that anecdotal notebook, which might be simply a copybook with the names of the children on each on a different page, and on that page will be observations or decisions that the teacher may have made about the children's learning that have happened as teaching and learning have been ongoing, but very short observations, very short descriptions of achievement. And only things that might be important would be written into what we call an anecdotal notebook. And that anecdotal notebook could focus on a subject area, but often the most effective ones are where the teacher keeps that anecdotal notebook, and in there are really important things for the teacher to remember that could be based right across the curriculum. It could be in music or PE or in art or in anything. So, for example, if a teacher happens to see that the child is having a difficulty in clapping a particular rhythm, the teacher might just make a little note about that. That's something that it would be important to remember. I need to do something about that another time. It could also be about maybe some social aspects or attitudinal aspects of learning. So the teacher might say, for example, in October, you know, that Sean really doesn't seem to like doing mathematics. He really says he doesn't like it. So I need to remember that. I need to remember, and I need to do something about it. So there might be a little note just to say that Sean today said he just didn't like maths. And it is a note for the teacher that next May, when the teacher is maybe meeting Sean's parents, there's an opportunity maybe to bring that up and have a conversation about it and to maybe explain what has happened in the meantime. So I think that it is important for teachers to keep a record, an ongoing record, based on their assessments for learning, but also, obviously, they keep records on the assessments of learning as well in the form of test results and report cards that go home at the end of the year.
And if we take those test results, whether they're standardised test results or whether they're the class test results, how does a teacher looks at the results for their class? How can they actually use the results to inform their work or to evaluate their work, or how, you know, how do you use the results?
I think it's a great question, because what you're actually getting at there is taking an assessment of learning and turning it into an assessment for learning. And let's talk about the very traditional, or not very traditional, but very formalized, standardized assessments. It is possible for a teacher to look at patterns of correct and incorrect responses on standardized tests, and to see whether or not, you know, there are indications for individual children or indications where there are common errors being made in her class. So it might be in say a standardized test of maths, for example, the teacher might note that quite a few children in her class had difficulties adding certain kinds of fractions. It provides an opportunity for teachers to identify what she might want to follow up with a whole class, or indeed with individual children. But it's also, I think, an opportunity as well to do the opposite, is to look at what children are really good at and to be able to build on that, to be able to say, you know, I can see things that my children do really, really well, and there are opportunities now for me to really extend what they can do. They've shown me they can really perform really, really well on these types of questions. I now want to take that information and I want to differentiate. I really do want to take the ones who are really strong and give them challenging work. And I want to take maybe some of the children who have difficulties or challenges and maybe identify how I could sit with them and help them. So I think you can do two things. The same with any assessment as well that the teacher may give. You know, it would be a shame if children just did an assessment and that the information from that assessment was not being used.
The other person, Michael, who gets a lot of assessment results is the principal. When the principal gets a big long set of results, you know, from junior infants to sixth class in a primary school, or in a post-primary school, it'll be from first year to sixth year, how can they use the results?
From the principal's point of view, there has to be some kind of tracking. I think it's an opportunity for the principal really to look longitudinally at data in a school. There are a lot of data in a school that sit in an office that don't get used. That it's data that, you know, that I think aren't mined properly. Now, this is not to say, Sean, that this is an easy thing to do, but on a very simple level, I think it would be really interesting in schools to look at patterns of outcomes for assessments as the children progress through the school, because the principal has that information. But I think most importantly, it's not just the principal should be doing this. I think the whole staff should be involved in looking at patterns, especially now when we have to, you know, we have to legally administer standardised tests in schools. I think it would be possible for principals to organise conversations among groups of teachers, but at a whole school level as well. I also think there are opportunities for principals to look at, let's say, school reports and how school reports are written and how people are making judgments across his or her school. So in the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment's report cards, there are descriptions of achievement, let's say, for English reading or writing or for mathematics or whatever. And I think there's some really interesting work to be done in a school with that information about how teachers are arriving at certain decisions about whether or not that writing over the course of a year can be described as a 4-star, 3-star. It's a chance for teachers to share information about how they're making judgments. And I think a principal could actually do some really, really good work in that sense. I also think there are opportunities as well for principals to organise conversations with the staff around, say, work samples. Let's say there is writing ranging from all the way from first class all the way to sixth, and how children are progressing and what kind of judgments we're making about writing. And can we take pieces of writing and can we make judgments about whether that is a good standard of writing for second class or third class. When we talk about progressions in writing through a school, I think that can only be done at the level of actual work samples, taking the children's work. So again, coming back to this idea of the assessment of learning and the assessment for learning, I think it's possible to take data from standardized tests, assessments of learning, or teacher-made tests, and use those data to generate conversations about learning and teaching in the school.
I suppose one thing a teacher might be nervous about if a principal is analysing results longitudinally, that, you know, if, say, children in third class had a particular set of results and then in fourth class maybe there's a drop, you know, would a teacher be justified in being nervous?
Yes, of course, Sean. I mean, I think that it would be naive of me to think that this is not without its risks. It's a difficult process to get really good learning and teaching environments in a school. One of the things that have to be put in place is that people have to be willing to say, well, I could do better. But also, I think it's very important that teachers understand that, you know, that especially around standardized testing, when people are looking at patterns of results and scores and that, not to read too much into individual tests. I think that would be very foolish. Because there are things that teachers do in classrooms that cannot be captured easily with standardized tests. The other thing, I suppose, as well, is that sometimes you get over-interpretations of what you described as drops in performance. So I could say pretty categorically that a child in third class who performs at the, let's say, the 60th percentile on a standardized test, and it goes into fourth class and performs at the 55th percentile, that categorically is not a drop. It is not a drop. And there are lots of reasons for that. And I suppose one of the things I'm very concerned about here in St. Patrick's College and making sure my students understand is the limitations inherent in standardised assessments.
Why do you say that's not a drop? If they're at the 60th percentile in third class and then they go to fourth class and they're at the 55th percentile.
Yeah, I'll explain it in two ways. In every assessment, we have this thing called measurement error. It's what I talked about before. It's not like taking a measuring tape and measuring absolutely accurately. We always know that there is some element of error in every assessment, whether it's a standardized test or a teacher observation. There is always going to be some element, that is not that it's wrong, but it's simply just the statement that we cannot see inside people's heads. We can't see exactly what is going on in a child's head when they're reading. So we can't take an absolutely precise measurement of reading. So if you read the guidelines around, say, standardized tests, it's very clear that a child who performs at the 60th percentile, that that's only an indication of the child's reading level at a point in time. And it also is very clear in the manuals around standardized tests that you always have to put a band of performance around a score like a 60th percentile. So the reality is that you can only say that on this day the child performed at the 60th percentile, but the child's true performance could be anywhere from the 35th percentile up to the 75th percentile. We don't know for sure, because we are basing it on one test at one point in time. The child who performed at the 66th percentile actually could have performed, his or her true score could be the 55th percentile, or it could be the 50th percentile. So on standardized tests, you actually need very large differences before you can say with reasonable certainty that a child's performance has improved or disimproved. I'll explain it another way. If a child performs at the 60th percentile in third class, on a third class test, and a child also performs at the 60th percentile in fourth class, on a fourth class test, logically, we know that the child has learned stuff between third and fourth class. Because the third class test, the child performed at the 60th percentile, the child also performed on a more difficult test at the 60th percentile. So to say that the child hasn't improved is a nonsense. So I think any logical person thinking about it would say, well, that is actually, the child has improved. The child has learned things between third and fourth class. Yes, the child hasn't improved in terms of a number, but we must remember too that that number has error associated with it. So we really have to treat these assessments, I think, as indications. And I suppose one of the key messages I try and also make sure that people understand is that you never base an important decision around one assessment. I would say that it would be very important to bring other pieces of information into the equation. So let's go back to the situation where a child has performed at the 60th percentile in third class, at the 55th percentile in fourth class, has performed at the 40th percentile in fifth class. Now, there's an indication there that there is something going on, but we can't say for definite that there is a problem. But if we look at other elements to the assessment story, the teacher may see that the child has been less engaged in reading over the last 2 years. The teacher may see that the child is less well able to complete the comprehension exercises. And so with a whole range of other information, the teacher can say, this test result does have some validity because I also see indications of this lowering of performance happening over the last couple of years. There's always something to be concerned about if you see, you know, a performance that looks like it's disimproving. But on the basis of a standardized test, you cannot say for definite that that is a problem. You have to bring other information into your decision making.
So it's a pattern you're looking for rather than a one-off.
It's a pattern, but it comes back to the reliability issue. Reliability also talks about consistency across different assessments. So we also want to see not only consistency within an individual assessment, we also want to see consistency of information going across a standardized test, teachers' everyday assessments, children's answers to questions, children's own self-assessments, the conversation with the parents or guardians, the conversation with the teacher last year. So I would simply say that, of course, there is inherent danger in looking at these kind of patterns, and there is inherent danger of comparisons and so on and so forth. Yes, and there will be teachers who will feel quite nervous maybe about doing this kind of work. But I think you will be extremely nervous if you believe that one assessment can give you an accurate result. But once you accept that one assessment cannot give you an accurate result, it's about building a picture, then I think there are other conversations to be had that are much less fraught and much less likely to result in people trying to pretend that there's a, you know, that there isn't a problem when there may be a problem. And it may have to do with the way the children are being taught. And that, again, of course, is a difficult conversation, but it's one I think the principal has to take responsibility for. If there are indications, and multiple indications, you know, that the children's reading in a particular grade level or with a particular teacher isn't working well, or that, you know, there's I think a principal teacher has to take responsibility for addressing that, but not in a way that holds that teacher up and hands out the standardized test scores as proof that there's a problem in third class or fourth class. I wouldn't see it like that at all.
I think the reason people get so hung up on test results is because they're numbers, and because the very fact that they're numbers, it kind of gives the impression that they're you know, fixed, and they're immovable. Yes. And so a bit like a measurement, as you said earlier.
You're absolutely right, and there is a sense that they have a credibility, and people think that it's objective measurement, and it's simply that is simply not true. And to be fair, every person who's ever developed a standardized test and all the really reputable standardized assessments will have documentation relating to them that says very specifically, please do not take a single score as an accurate measure of a child's achievement. It's a score from one occasion at one point in time, and that score has to have measurement error, simply because we could not create a test with every possible question we could have asked that child. We have just a sample of questions. So the same way as a sample of 1,000 people in a referendum survey can only give you an indication of what those 1,000 people, but it can be pretty accurate. But you will always hear in those surveys people saying, you know, the responses are accurate to plus or minus 3%.
The margin of error.
Yeah. So there's like in the case of a survey, we see this in papers all the time. They're always saying, look, if somebody says that, you know, there's a satisfaction rating of 50% for the government, they will always say that's considered to be accurate within plus or minus 3%. So in other words, 50% we're saying is not, we're not sure whether that's accurate or not. In educational assessment, the very same ideas, except this time instead of surveying people, we're surveying questions. And in a test, we only have a selection of questions. So clearly, there is a margin of error. In the first sense, we have a thing called sampling error, simply because we just sample people. In the second one, we have both sampling error from the questions, but we also have measurement error. We're never quite sure whether the questions we're asking are good enough. So we have to be slightly sceptical, not cynical, because these assessments are really good. They're well, most of them, the Irish ones are really well developed. Teachers should be using them. They do give another piece of information that's really important. They do have Irish standards and Irish norms. But you have to always build in other elements, other information before making important decisions about how children are doing.
And that was Dr. Michael O'Leary from St. Patrick's College, putting standardised tests in perspective and bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. I'll bring you the remainder of my interview with Michael on the topic of assessment next week. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.